Hey, everyone. This is Genevieve Shalone, and welcome to For Kindness Sake. This is a show that's all about good people who do nothing but great things. And today, I am with James Montgomery.
Hello.
How are you today? And where have you been this morning? Because I love the hat t-shirt combo.
I've literally just come from Battersea Park. It's the National Autistic Society's Colour Spectrum Walk, annual walkathon, I guess you could call it. This is something which they do every year, bring families, friends, allies of autism together to go for a big old walk around Battersea Park and raise money.
That sounded like a pretty busy morning. So as a result, thank you so much for even taking the time to do this today.
My pleasure. It's great to be in London.
So from doing my research about you, you were diagnosed with autism over 25 years ago, roughly, more or less. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. 25 years this year. Originally, it was diagnosed as what they called it back then, high functioning Asperger syndrome.
Okay.
As our understanding of autism has evolved over the years, Asperger syndrome became part of the autistic spectrum. And officially, I am autistic.
Okay, yes, because that was my next follow-up question. If you could give a quick summary on what autism is. Like a ballpark summary, because not everyone may necessarily be that
familiar with
the phrase. But you already summed it up quite nicely about your diagnosis.
Well, yeah, I guess the diagnosis helps with it. So for clarification, guys, I have a lived experience of being autistic, but that doesn't mean that I'm a psychologist or I'm a professional in any way. So for this part, I'm just going to quote what the National Autistic Society have on their website for what is autism. So per what the charity state, autism influences how people experience and interact with the world. It is a lifelong neurodivergence and disability. Autistic people are different from each other, but for a diagnosis, they must share differences from non-autistic people in how they think, feel, and communicate. So basically, being autistic means you may feel things and react to them differently to non-autistic people. You may find socializing confusing, tiring, and you may even become overwhelmed in loud or busy places. You may have intense interests, prefer order and routine, and use repeated movements or actions to calm yourself or express joy. People call this stimming, so you may hear me use that a few times in the podcast. You might mask your discomfort to fit in, and this is typically what can lead to mental illnesses because, for a better word, you're making a facade of yourself to fit in with society. So that's the textbook definition of what is autism.
That's perfect. And it's funny that you mentioned the National Autistic Society because I'm actually just about to read a little fact that I pulled from their website, which says, quote, that more than one in 100 people are on the autism spectrum, and there are around 700,000 autistic adults and children in the UK, which that's obviously quite the number there, James. And I guess you would also agree, as you kind of mentioned there from that dialogue you were reading, that autism affects people in different ways. Would you like to maybe share how it affects you, for example, maybe on like a day-to-day experience, maybe like highlighting some strengths and weaknesses, perhaps, if you're comfortable to share?
Sure, absolutely. I'm a very open book to this topic, so throw the questions my way. But I guess you could say, so how does autism impact me? So my social skills, I would say, are fairly good. It does take a lot of conscious effort to be able to socialize in a standard way, I guess you could say, in a way which society deems to be as normal. So that will tire me out by the end of the day. I guess you could say doing stuff like this, people won't really notice it that much, but we get to 5 o'clock and I go, okay, I need to just go somewhere dark and quiet now and to just completely shut off and recharge the batteries. Now that kind of moves us into where I would say being autistic does impact me from a sensory point of view. So I'm very sensitive to sound. I will pick up on things miles away, but you know, a long distance away. Sudden loud noises is my kryptonite, particularly like fire alarms, things exploding and stuff. It does give me an absolute sensory overload to the point that it triggers my tinnitus. And I kind of get like black spots in my vision. So it's just a complete overload. And when that happens, that's when I need to just hideaway, I guess you could say. So that for me, I would say, is the big one. The spectrum, though, is quite vast. It lists many different quirks, I guess you could call them, within it. So social interactions, fixations, your routine, executive function, stimming as well. I don't stim as strongly as perhaps other autistic people may, but if you get to know me well enough, you probably get to see it from time to time. My hands do a little tappity dance. My sister calls it me going into Chucky Finster mode, so a nice reference to Rugrats there. But I would say in some aspects, I am on the more outer areas of the spectrum, particularly when it comes to noise and sensitivity.
Okay.
Other areas, I'm probably somewhere more in the middle. But that's what makes being autistic unique, because how it impacts me is very different to perhaps another autistic person who might be nonverbal, and so obviously their social skills are going to be very different to mine, and so we need to find a new solution to enable them and to allow them to be part of the community.
That's very insightful. You obviously listed there regarding to like sensory experiences that were a bit more on the challenging side.
Yes.
Do you have any that are like perhaps maybe like comforting and soothing? Like what makes you feel comfortable?
A dark room.
Okay.
No one gets it, but to me, there is nothing more comforting than being in a dark room with my computer just playing on games and just letting the tempo reset, letting things just get back into, I guess you could say, a world which I understand. This is very much an old coping mechanism of mine from since I went to primary school, because I'd be so burnt out after a day of school. And not many parents could understand that, because you know, you go and do after school class, go and do your football and that. Whereas no, I wanted just to go home, close the curtains and just go and play my computer until I was ready to speak to people again. I'm 33 now, and there's still nothing more comforting than after a busy day of work to just go, right, okay, goodbye, everyone.
So it's your safety blanket.
Absolutely.
Amazing. I want to move on to slightly something a little different. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I want to talk to you about an interview that you did back a couple years ago in 2023.
Okay.
It was something that was broadcasted on ITV in Jersey Channel Island.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Yes. And for those of you who don't know where Jersey is, I'm not talking about New Jersey stateside. I'm talking about a little island that's off the coast of France. Everyone there speaks English, but the road signs are in French. The best way to describe it. Would you agree?
That was a perfect way of describing it. And for context, for anyone in the UK, it's 100 miles south of England. So if you think it's the one on the edge of Portsmouth, which you can see, no, that's the Isle of Wight. Keep going another 100 miles until you get to the coast of France. Then you can find Jersey.
Exactly. Circling back, though, to interview in question. Oh, no, we love a digression every
now
and then.
Oh, I tangent. I will completely tangent. So just call me out on it. Be like, tangent, okay, back to the subject.
Oh, absolutely no worries at all. But yes, going back to the interview in question.
Of course.
I watched this video, and you were followed around by the TV camera crew at your workplace. And I want to highlight a particular part of that interview, how you talked about that it's okay to say the word autistic in response to your work colleagues coming up to you when they found out about your diagnosis, about you having autism. And with that, do you feel like perhaps that some people were afraid to use that particular term because they didn't want to come across as perhaps insensitive or, you know, this thing about being not politically correct, which is like a huge thing these days?
Oh, it's a huge thing. You've hit the nail on the head there, actually. Social media is such a double-edged sword because it brings a voice to the masses and it really does highlight underrepresented communities. In the particular case of neurodiversity and autism, our understanding of it has evolved. It has changed a lot in the last 25 years. And I would say because of that, there's a lot of confusion as to what's the correct terminology to use now, what's the correct, for a better word, labeling to use. But then you also factor in you've got different generations coming in as well. So for context, when I originally got my diagnosis, it was called high-functioning Asperger syndrome. That was my badge of honor. That was quite my identity. But, you know, as a kid, that was something I could relate to. It gave me an understanding as to this is why I behave the way I do. And if anyone wanted to doubt me. It was kind of my motivation to prove them wrong because, yeah, I have Asperger syndrome. And then one day I got to university, and I will answer the question in a minute, just giving a bit of context here. But I got to university, and there was a support group there for other people with learning difficulties, neurodivergence, etc. And I decided to join there, and I introduced myself to the group, said, yep, I've got Asperger syndrome. And someone got really upset with me. He was like, no, it's not called Asperger syndrome anymore. It's autism. Asperger was a Nazi. Never say that word again.
Oh, wow, right.
And for context, guys, unfortunately, the person who originally diagnosed Asperger syndrome, or who it was named after, yes, he was part of the Nazi parties there. Completely different topic. Very insightful to do some reading on. I will provide Jen with the links so you can do your reading on this one afterwards. But in the case for me, this was my, you know, Asperger syndrome was what I was diagnosed with. This was my badge of honor, if you like. And suddenly my identity had now offended someone else. So part of my journey was to relearn, actually, it's not Asperger syndrome anymore. It actually falls within the autistic spectrum. And so part of my journey was to understand that it's okay for the labels to evolve as our understanding evolves. Now, that kind of conversation I had in that room is what you find happening in social media a lot. If you use the wrong term, you get absolutely grilled by very passionate people who are obviously there to defend for loved ones, for their friends. But the amount of toxicity which comes with it, I think actually scares a lot of people into using any words now, because what they think is the normal word to use, they're worried that they're going to offend people. And I think that's why a lot of people at work were afraid to actually even say the word autistic to me, in case that was the wrong word to use and I was going to take offense to it. This was why I did this feature with ITV, because actually, you know, from a factual point of view, that is the correct word, autistic. And for someone to come up to me and say, oh, I never knew that you were, you know... Whilst I've got a thick enough skin now, 25 years down the line, to kind of laugh it off, for perhaps someone who's quite new in their journey and perhaps they're using that autistic badge as their badge of honour, to have someone not be comfortable to speak to them about the label, that could be of detriment to them. So I want to reassure people that it's okay to have the conversation. It's okay to use the words. And even if you don't get it right, the right people who will enable you will work with you, so we're all speaking the same language and moving forwards together. For me, the most important thing is curiosity. You can always do something about ignorance. You can always educate someone if they're using the wrong labels, because that is kind of what happens as our understanding evolves, terminologies change. It's, autism is just an example of this. This happens in all shapes and sizes within society, the diversity and inclusive community. Curiosity. If you've got that, then you can do something positive with it tomorrow. And as far as I'm concerned, curiosity is not a discrimination.
That is true. And I guess, like, on the topic of curiosity, some of the things you listed there, I want to kind of deep dive a little bit further, specifically on the subject of empathy, as this is a show about kindness, of course. And I guess it's safe to say, like, in a sort of like workplace environment, empathy is quite like a crucial thing, because it impacts, you know, it can impact your job, it impacts your performance, because you're at work pretty much like almost every day. And I would say a lack of empathy would obviously quite have a big impact on that. Whereas showing things like support, encouragement, and like you said, positive curiosity could obviously have a good impact on that person. And I want to ask you, what are some of the ways employers at companies or firms can demonstrate empathy towards an employee who may have neurodiverse needs in order to help them thrive at work?
Have the conversation. It's as simple as that, really. It's about creating that environment where the individual feels safe enough that they can talk about the topic. I personally don't expect people to have the answers. Ironically, actually, the people in my life who have enabled me the most, like through education, they were the old school teachers. You know, they were taught in the 60s where you either had a smart student or one who wore the dunce cap. They knew nothing about special needs, but what they saw was an individual who was trying. this way wasn't working, but because I was putting in the effort, they were willing to work with me to find the line of communication which worked for me, because they could see I was answering the questions on paper, but when they were speaking to me, it was like a foreign language. So they were willing to try something different. And I would say it was exactly that mindset from managers at work which got the best out of me as well. They were willing to try something different. And ultimately, by creating this safe environment where I could be more myself, the conversations evolved organically as a result. And by trialing an error, I mean, what worked for me in my last job may not work for me this time. You know, that is part of development. Each situation, you need to have a different coping mechanism for it. But having someone that you can work with to have the confidence to, the way that we would probably see it as perfectionist, fail and actually learn from it, and you develop even more as a result afterwards. Those were my biggest allies, those who were willing to just to try something different.
What are some of the adjustments that have been made for you specifically for workplace, particularly before where you talked about dislike and being sensitive towards like super loud noises? So I could imagine your office would have a fire alarm and fire drills. Is that something they've taken into consideration as well?
Oh, all of that. All of the above there. Starting off with the noise sensitivity parts. So generically, the office is open plan. Now, if you've got a couple hundred people in this big open plan office, that's a lot of noise. The noise itself isn't actually an issue for me. I can deal with a constant loud noise in the background. Problem is, it's voices, and I can hear every single one of those conversations. And that's what kind of overstimulates my brain, because I'm trying to understand every conversation at the same time, as well as the one which I'm hearing right in front of me. Obviously, if I'm trying to type an email or something, I end up typing what I'm hearing rather than what I'm thinking. So a quick win there was to just move me to a back of a room in the quiet corner. That was a double win, actually, because there's a lot of bright lights in the office as well. That corner had no direct light above it. Great. It's darker and quieter than anywhere else in the building. So whenever people hear the words reasonable adjustments and they're thinking, oh, we've got to develop like individual pod rooms or something like that. No, actually, it's worth just having that conversation with the individual, because relocating their table could be the quick win which you need to enable that individual there. And it certainly did for me. Moving on to the fire alarms. Yes, so that is my kryptonite, as I've said. So work. Right, James, there'll be a fire alarm at about 10:30. When? Every week on a Wednesday. All right, okay, fair enough. So if I was caught in the fire alarm, it just, the noise of it is so piercing. It goes through my ears. It sets off the tinnitus. It gives me the black spots in my eyes and leaves me useless for the rest of the day. That's like my whole battery depleted just in that one go there.
Oh, wow.
I'm utterly useless for the rest of the day because I just can't focus. I even find it real effort just to try and speak to someone, because all I can hear is the ringing and I'm still trying to get my eyesight back going again. Can also be quite rage-inducing as well, but thankfully I've got a lot of coping mechanisms with that, because whilst you can get away with having a rage at 9 years old, people take less sympathy at 33 if you go and punch a wall or something. So yeah, I've obviously got my own coping mechanisms now. But a quick win to that was literally locking down the time. So it's not 10:30-ish, it's 10:30. Rather than getting some guy to come in and turn the key to trigger all the alarms, they've set up on the computer. So it is literally 10:30 on the dot. That consistency then means I can go and stick a reminder in my Outlook calendar 5 minutes before. Right, it's 10:25, get out the building. I spend 5 minutes, get out of the building, get to the other side of the road, whatever, so I'm away from the noise. Hear the fire alarm go off, that's fine. It's done. Everyone's safe for another week. Everyone carries on with their day because they're not impacted by it, but I can walk back into the building and carry on with the rest of my day without feeling completely worn out in a complete sensory overload as well. So these are, I guess you could call them little things. It's thinking outside the box. It's just working with your line manager, with HR, in this case, the facilities manager. Can we do something about this? Actually, yes. Yes, we can. We've already got this here. So it's about having that conversation, because to everyone else, it will probably not make a hoot of difference to them. To me, that made a huge impact, because it meant suddenly I was still able to work for the other 6 hours of the day.
Yeah, it seems like just the teeny tiniest adjustment, and simply just having that dialogue really seems to have quite a big impact in a good way. And I want to move on a little bit about just like, you know, when people apply for jobs, there's always that interview stage, recruitment process. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what are some of the ways employers can adjust their recruitment processes so a neurodiverse person can feel more comfortable at a job interview. Because I don't know about you, but job interviews can be pretty scary, especially with the multiple stages. For certain jobs, you're required to do a task. So how could they make somebody more comfortable with particular needs?
Oh, it's...
Would you say more it's like a case-by-case individual, simply having that dialogue?
It really is. Yes, it is case-by-case. I would say it's trying to evolve a process. So rather than reacting to someone having to reach out to you as the recruiter and saying, oh, by the way, I have this condition, can we do X, Y, and Z and have this one considered? It's about making that part of the recruitment process itself. So rather than them having to come out and ask you for the things, you're already a step ahead. Is there anything we need to consider? Are there any adjustments we need to make for this? It's turning that reactive situation into a proactive one. Now, the success rate of that is debatable. My personal feeling is it's very 50-50, because it really does come down to the confidence of that individual if they're comfortable enough to share that information. There are a lot of people out there who are still very worried that by disclosing this information, they're going to be discriminated and they won't even be offered a job interview as a result. I wish I had a solution for that one, because it really is about putting your trust in someone. I'm at a point in life now where I will disclose this information, because otherwise I'm just presenting a facade and I'm doing myself a disservice as well as them. And actually, if by me disclosing this information, they don't want anything to do with me, they're doing me a favor, because that's now avoiding me from actually going into that environment, which will burn me out. And that's actually a place I don't want to work in. Society is evolving. Society is changing, and it's much more adaptive to our needs now. There are more and more allies out there who, and I get it, everyone's at a different stage of their journey, but from what I've seen over the last 25 years, there are more people that you can have this conversation with, and asking for the request, you're well within your rights to. From a social point of view, from a legal point of view, if you look at the UK Equality Act, for example, one of the rules in there states it's an anticipatory duty of a company to find reasonable adjustments for their employees. Anticipatory duty. Now, that to me is a key word, because I think a lot of people, they feel they have to go and provide the paperwork, they have to provide the medical certificates to justify there is something wrong with me. But the law is actually saying you need to anticipate it. So if you can see that person is struggling, why aren't you doing something about it? That's just being a good manager, as far as I'm concerned. Take neurodiversity out of this. This is just about two people having a conversation. You can do this with your recruitment process as well. Have I got enough time to share a quick case study of one
if
which
you would
I've
like,
seen?
Yeah,
go for it.
Absolutely.
So I'll keep it entirely anonymized. But I am aware in the Channel Islands that there was a company in the finance industry who had given a job interview to someone who had disclosed that they had Tourette's syndrome. And they absolutely tanked the job interview. They said this wasn't the person they were expecting based on the CV. They seemed very agitated, just very out of it. And they just went, yeah, this isn't going to work at all. Now, this applicant was supported by a charity who helps coach people with recruitment strategies and finding people perhaps with learning disabilities jobs. And they fed back to the HR of that company and said, look, you're aware that they have Tourette's syndrome, but we've actually recognized we've done them a disservice, because this interview was on a Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. and they've had a whole day of suppressing their tics, of masking, a full day of work, and then coming for a job interview as well. So they were mentally absolutely tired. Would you be open to a second chance and we try this at 9 a.m. on the Tuesday instead. Okay, fair enough. So they did the interview again. Night and day difference. They were absolutely on it. They weren't burnt out from a whole day of masking their tics. And they were suddenly able to demonstrate and communicate in the way which their CV that they were expecting, based on what they had seen on the CV, that person had now come alive because they put them in an environment which enabled them to be able to be who they claimed that they were on the CV. And it's something as little as that. That doesn't cost anything. That's just changing the time of the interview. Positive difference.
Yeah, no, wow. That was very insightful. Thank you for sharing that. I guess like the my takeaway from that is just allowing the individuals to take the mask off so they don't have to pretend, they don't have to mask themselves. Just let them be themselves.
It's liberating.
Exactly.
It really is, because you can just be yourself then. The energy goes into having the conversation rather than, oh, what are they going to think about me if I try and do this whilst responding to it? So tone it back. And that way you're just knackering yourself up more.
Yeah, I would say, as you said, the understanding and terminologies are ever changing, ever evolving. And for me personally, I would say definitely like 10, 15, 20 years ago, neurodiversity, I did not know what that phrase was. There was too much I did not know. But then over the years, as you say, like more and more content is out there available, more and more resources.
Yeah.
But even also just like having, as you say, like a open dialogue with people and myself having met various people, all walks of life over the years, whether it's workplace, university, et cetera, I would feel like that definitely has shaped my personal understanding on the subject, meeting all like types of people. And, you know, you mentioned the word there, like genuine curiosity. I try to approach these things with empathy the best way I could. And as you say, genuine curiosity, is this something that you hope for when you meet new people for the first time?
Honestly, yes. I did an interview last year, and if they pinched one of my quotes off it, I didn't even realize I said this, but basically I said, ignorance is just my opportunity to meet my next ally.
That's a great quote.
And I do actually stick by that now, the more I think about it, because we all come from different backgrounds. We all have our own definition of what is normal. And, you know, if you were to throw that into the full diversity and inclusion, let's call it a spectrum for the sake of this conversation, you know, there are so many things which judge or alter what we see as being normal. You know, it can be our gender, it can be our religion, our race, neurodiversity, if you have any physical health conditions, invisible disabilities, mental health conditions. Then if you really go down to the granular stuff, you could have two people from the same village, for example, same culture, but they went to two different schools. Now they're going to have two different versions of normal as well, because they had two different versions of education going on. Even something as subtle as how a person looks. You know, you judge people differently like that. So when you take all of that into consideration, no wonder so many people kind of come to blows, because we all think of something being normal. Actually, it's very different to what me and you will think is normal. That's why I don't really like the term common sense, because we all have our own definition of what is common. If we can move past that conversation quicker of, right, what is normal, and accept we have two different viewpoints on this, meet in the middle, the sooner you can have that conversation, the sooner you start turning that conversation into one about, okay, how can I help you? What do you need? What can we do to make this work for you? And everyone has a responsibility for that, not just a manager in the business. We all need allies.
Yeah, it's a whole like collectiveness. It's like essentially being supportive towards particular communities, really. I also want to like talk about just like interactions with people in general, whether it's like people that you currently know or like when you meet new people in social settings or anything like that. Could be anything. What makes you feel understood or accepted by new people that you meet?
Treat me as you see me. I am Monty at the end of the day. No,
that almost rhymes.
It did, there we are. The poet, I didn't know it. Oh, now I'm off on one. Okay, there we are. So, yeah, no, honestly, treat me as you see me, because I am literally Monty. I know a lot of people still in the terms of autism, I know a lot of people use the badge as a badge of honor. I did as a kid, and it certainly brought me lots of comfort. And as the labels have evolved, as our understanding has evolved, I've disassociated more with it the older I've got, because I don't really feel the need to go around saying, hi, I'm autistic, James. Because there's a lot of people out there, when you say the word autistic, they suddenly go and look for the textbook example of it. They go to Google, they go and look at the medical book, whatever, and they start expecting me to behave like the textbook says. But you don't look autistic to me. Or you don't behave autistic to me, because I have a cousin who's autistic and you're nothing like them. So actually, to avoid a lot of those misconceptions, I literally just go around and tell people I'm Monty. So take me at face value. We'll probably have a conversation at some point where I will bring up that I am autistic. And obviously those kind of conversations will naturally flow as a result. But don't start comparing me to the textbook definition. Because if you had to describe me in three words, those who know me really well, they don't include autistic in those three words. If anything, they include Monty in there, because I'm that unique that I am basically my own verb and adjective. And that's the way I want it to be.
And that will probably be in like Word of the Year of 2025.
That'd be fantastic.
You mentioned there, I noticed you mentioned like a couple of like the misconceptions there, particularly about appearance, because you're right. It's not about like a look. No. As you say, kind of like a Wikipedia style or like textbook kind of description. Can you think of maybe like other kind of common misconceptions there are of people who are neurodivergent?
Yes, I can think of many. Some people still seem surprised that I have a degree.
Can you elaborate?
I think a lot of people still see neurodivergence as being an intelligence issue. It's definitely not an intelligence issue. It's one about communication. It's one about how your brain processes the world compared to others. Within that, with the way that how you see the world, you're going to come out with different conclusions perhaps to another person will. That doesn't mean you're smarter. Certainly doesn't mean that you're dumber than another person. You're just seeing it differently. And actually, if we all embraced how we all see the world, you start building really unique ideas as a result of it, because perhaps there is another method to completing that task, which we hadn't thought about before. Actually, that person has found a much more effective way of getting to that end goal, much quicker, less steps involved. You know, you hear of so many high profile examples of entrepreneurs, business leaders who are dyslexic, have ADHD, because they are more, without stereotyping, but tend to be more creative in their way of thinking. They're fantastic at problem solving. Look at Richard Branson and the kind of empire that he's built up, because he was looking at opportunities which no one else could see.
Do you know what diagnosis he has? Because I wasn't aware of...
Sir Richard Branson, so I believe it's dyslexia and ADHD is what he advocates on that one. Yeah, so I would say that's still a big misconception when people... Actually, if we're going to go much bigger on this one, have you ever heard of the term neurodiversity umbrella?
No. Can you elaborate?
Right. So neurodiversity umbrella is an umbrella term for all the kind of conditions which falls within neurodiversity. Now, this is probably the biggest misconception in itself, because most people assume that this just means it's autism, it's ADHD, it's dyslexia, it's Tourette's syndrome. I guess you could arguably call them the more obvious ones, because they're the ones which get the most attention in the media. These are just some of the conditions which fall under this umbrella. You could call them neurodivergent, because those conditions, this is where they say that you tend to see the world differently to perhaps someone who is neurotypical, Joe Bloggs. But if you look at neurodiversity as a whole umbrella, it also factors in physical health. How often do you hear people saying that if they have like a vitamin deficiency and they're not thinking themselves, they need to get food in them or something like that? So obviously, if you've got like a physical condition going on and your brain's not able to function properly, you're going to start thinking differently. Likewise with mental health. That was a huge misconception for many years, was that autism was a form of mental health. It's been flipped around on its head now. Autism is the condition. Mental health tends to come as a consequence from people having to mask that condition because they're so tired. So, you know, when I first started getting support, autism was within the mental health department of hospitals. So that has changed a lot, and they've now become separated as a result. The other interesting one is acquired neurodiversity.
What was that, sorry?
Acquired.
Acquired. Okay.
Acquired, as in you have obtained
right.
it.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So, which I think for some people sounds absolutely daft. So I'm sure there's probably going to be some viewers going, aha, I knew those injections were a thing. I'm not talking about the injections, okay? That has been disproven so many times, so I'm not going to entertain that one at all. But there are some serious topics in here where you can acquire neurodiversity. If someone has had, for example, a stroke, their way of thinking has now fundamentally changed because they have, for a better word, had a brain injury. Concussion, that's another one there. You're having to retrain your brain, reuse the gray matter to be able to do what you were able to do beforehand. Perhaps there are going to be some things you can't do anymore as a result. I had concussion when I was 18 and I can't use both my hands to play a piano anymore. So that was a consequence for me. So technically you could say I'm double neurodivergent. But when you start looking at it in a much broader term like that, and you realize it's not just those four conditions, and actually it applies to everyone. Hypermobility, Parkinson's disease, you know, there's so many different conditions on this. I will send a link so people can actually see what this umbrella looks like, because it's vast. And then suddenly you go, actually, it's not just a small portion of people. It impacts so many people in many, many different ways. So that for me is the biggest misconception of all, is to actually think it's just a couple of people impacted by this.
It's essentially like a spider web connection. It all kind of like interlinks with one another.
Precisely.
So I guess it is very important to have, like, for individuals to have the right and support system around them, whether that's friends or family. Would you agree?
Yep, 100%. Because ultimately, if we're talking about neurodiversity, not divergence, diversity, then, well, based on what it's saying there, it literally says it on the label on the tin. We are talking about everyone, because the concept is we are talking about how everyone processes information uniquely. Can I give a very quick example?
Yes, I love any, by the way, any examples you have, please share, like anything, go for it.
Okay, right, quick maths question then. Let's see if we're going to panic or turn.
For me, math question.
Yes.
Oh, I will fail this.
Fantastic.
I will fail math. I am so bad at math, guys.
Brilliant. So we're having neurodiversity straight away here. Okay, so the question is 27 plus 48.
Oh my goodness.
No calculator, no cheating.
Okay, well, I won't use my device. What was the number again?
27
plus
48.
27
plus
48. That would be... Made my fingers?
Go for it.
Okay. six. 75?
Yes.
Oh, thank God.
Now, I want you to explain to the audience how you got to that conclusion. Tell me the method that you got to get there.
Ooh, I feel like I'm back in high school again. Like, math was my... Honestly, math was like... I mean, I was okay at school, but math... Ooh, math... Math did things to me. I'm like, ooh, geometry, trigonometry, algebra, whatever those terms are. But how I got to that was I kind of just broke down like the bigger numbers without like the second digit, if that makes sense. So I just did, what were the numbers again?
27 was, and 48.
Yeah. So what I did there was I just simply did 48 plus 20.
Okay.
And then I had the 7 after. So that's how I always
do
it.
So you got to 75 that way. Fantastic. If that was me, I would have rounded them both up to the nearest whole number.
Uh-huh.
So 27, 48, that for me would have been 30 plus 50. And then whatever the difference for 27 to 30, so minus 3, that's 77. 50 minus 48, 2, so minus 2 gets to 75. Two very different ways of using a method to get to the same answer. And that is a perfect definition of how neurodiversity is explained. Because
okay.
we both have our own unique way of getting to the same conclusion, but we made it.
Oh, wow. That was really... Do you have another example?
Ooh, that's the best one I wanted to give, just because most people panic when they hear maths.
Oh, yeah. No,
responded to that.
Oh, my goodness. As soon as you said math, I was like, oh, my God, no, I'm going to fail this.
Exactly. And a lot of that stems from, because the way we were taught at school was one way. And if that doesn't work for us, we panic, we self-doubt ourselves. Actually, it's about finding the method which works best for you. And you did actually find the method which works best for you.
Yeah.
That is your coping mechanism. That's how you've coped. That's how you've got to the conclusion. And I have my own way of doing that as well. But we both got there in the end. So who am I to tell you that your way was wrong, and who are you to tell me that my way was wrong? Because we both got there in our own way in about the same time as well.
Yeah, no.
Neurodiversity.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about things like how there's more understanding these days and like workplace environments. Do you feel like it's the same for like schools as well? Like particularly at primary level where children's brains are still evolving?
Oh, completely. I probably won't be able to give the best explanation for this because I don't have kids. I can only speak about it of what education was like back in my day.
Yeah, if you would like to share.
In the 90s. But it does sound like progress has been made and that teachers do enable a lot more critical thinking. They enable children to find their own solution. The most important thing is about finding the end goal. Certainly when I was a kid, you do your times table, you did it this way, you kind of did the songs which went with it. One times one is one, one times two is two, and you kind of all did it together. So it was just drilled in your head. It was very regimental almost. I was okay with that. I could remember it that way. It doesn't work for other people though, because you can turn it into song, doesn't work for them. They need a visual example to remember. Some need a verbal example to remember. I think that has changed a lot nowadays, for perhaps not across the whole of the UK. There are definitely some schools which are doing better than others. I'm hearing some parents I've spoken to lately, they, for example, their teacher has basically told the kid, it's my way, you'll get out. And the kid doesn't want to be in that environment because it stresses them out so much. So they're voluntarily playing up to get out of that classroom because they want to be out of that environment. To them, that's the lesser of two evils. You sometimes still hear about how some schools are, for example, what really helped me a lot in education was having time out, a quiet room. So the teachers were on board with this concept and went, if James is getting overwhelmed, overstimulated, this room is dedicated for students just to go and have 15 minutes to themselves. It's quiet, it's dark, like a sensory room type thing. There are some schools out there that still believe the student needs to earn that right. So almost like earn a voucher to go to the quiet room because they've been a good student for the whole week.
Is it just like, it sounds like a bit of a reward system there where...
A what, sorry?
A reward system?
Yes, yeah. A reward system. And that's, to me, that's not really being inclusive. That's still saying we will reward you because you've done it my way. Holistically speaking, that's not inclusion. Inclusion is both of you coming to the middle and finding a decent compromise which works for both.
Exactly. It's having a mutual agreement. It shouldn't be a competition like the X Factor or anything like that. It has to be mutual agreement so both parties are comfortable at the end of the day and for people to achieve their full potential.
Absolutely.
Because that's what everyone wants.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, whether it is at a school or whether they're working as adults, like
the common goal
is for them to thrive and achieve their full potential.
Oh, definitely.
There shouldn't be any roadblocks or
definitely not.
Anything 100%. Like that.
Thankfully, all I'm saying there seems to be rather the exception rather than the norm. Things have evolved over the last 20 odd years. As I say, it's unfortunate to hear that there are some schools still out there which have that mindset because it definitely didn't help me when I was in that environment. As I say, the teachers who got the most out of me were those who were willing to try something different rather than just saying, I'm the teacher, I'm right because I said so. That just doesn't help anyone, irrespective of being neurodivergent or not. That's just a form of arrogance as far as I'm concerned. For the schools which have done it right, and there are many, they've created an environment where everyone is included. When I was a student, the teachers didn't really know what to do with me. So until the end of year four, I was on my own table because they saw they felt I was a distraction to the rest of the class because I couldn't communicate with people very well.
So the teachers essentially separate you from your peers.
Exactly, because separation is the best way of inclusion, right? Segregation. There we go. Don't take that one seriously, guys. Mm-hmm. But no, so you don't get that kind of attitude anymore. It's about having these open conversations. Kids are by far the most curious of us all. That's when their brain is developing the most. They will ask unfiltered questions because that moral conscience isn't there. They want to understand how everything works. It's all about why. So why are we discouraging children from trying to find out? And actually, there's an opportunity to say, okay, this person has Tourette's. He's doing these tics because this is part of the condition, and actually explain it to the kids so they can understand more about it. You're beginning to see, I would say, with Gen Z now, coming back to the generation part of this.
Oh, yeah.
With each generation, there's more exposure. With each generation, they're more educated. Gen Z and Gen Alpha, as they're now beginning to come into the workplace, they've basically had 20 years of exposure now. You know, they've gone through school being in the classroom with neurodivergent children, very diverse group sets of children of all different races, religion, and it's all about having the conversation. I would argue that they're probably the most educated coming into the workforce, and they're very comfortable to have conversations which their managers aren't necessarily comfortable to have. Fantastic example for me a couple of years ago was when the fire alarm went off accidentally in our workplace. Someone had punched one of the things in, and so it went off when I wasn't expecting it to. So the fire alarm went off. I did what I normally do, which is jump underneath a table, scared and terrified.
Oh, no. I guess, yeah, because it was one of those that you didn't have time to put it in your Outlook calendar because it was unexpected.
But, exactly. But that was
to
me
clarify, was it a false alarm?
It was a false alarm.
Okay.
it was a false alarm because someone had punched the fire alarm thing. And so it triggered the fire alarm. So it wasn't scheduled. It was a false alarm.
Right.
Now, obviously, as anyone shouldn't do, jump under a table, you're supposed to get out of the building. But obviously, my first gut reaction was to jump underneath the table. Mm. My line manager is fantastic, but you can see she's still on a learning journey because I've taught her a lot about neurodiversity. And she just went, is everything okay? Whereas my trainee just literally had 20 years of exposure of neurodiversity in school, literally grabbed my hand, pulled me out the table, went, come on, let's go outside, and made me a cup of tea and went, take all the time you need and come back in afterwards. And that gives me hope for the next generation because they've got that much awareness, that amount of education on the subject that I don't want to see their curiosity get discouraged now that they're coming to the workplace because managers and leaders aren't ready to have this conversation. Because they're ready, they have a lot of knowledge to bring to the businesses. And I certainly don't want to see anyone who's gone through education and be enabled. You know, 20, 30 years ago, when I had my diagnosis, I wasn't expected to pass GCSEs. Pushing trolleys in a supermarket was my career goal. So my journey was about proving people wrong because the knowledge they had then was it was an intelligence thing. It's not. It's a communication thing. Once people worked out how to communicate with me, I went through, I got 9 GCSEs. I completed 2 different BTEC courses, a BTEC level 3 courses. I got a degree in motorsport technology at the University of Hertfordshire. And then I went on and did another level 5 diploma course afterwards in learning and development. By being able to communicate with me in a certain way, that enabled me. So what we're now seeing are people who are coming 30 years ago, they wouldn't have passed education. They are now educated. They're getting the qualifications. They're coming into the workplace. And the managers and the leaders don't actually know what to do. That support circle, which was there in education, is gone. And I can certainly vouch for this. I left university feeling like nothing can stop me now. And I had to restart the whole journey again because the awareness wasn't there. The understanding wasn't there. And I don't want to see the Gen Z guys get dissuaded by this as they come into the workplace because we're not ready for their knowledge.
Wow, yeah. I definitely learned a lot about all the different touch points that you mentioned, whether it's like workplace, education, umbrella terms, math. I really have, having this conversation with you is so important and something I really, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on is a topic that I really wanted to highlight and share with everyone on the show, and hopefully, you know, this encourages somebody, whatever journey they are on, whether they are on the spectrum themselves or whether they have friends or allies. Yeah, I just really wanted to share this with people here on the show. So thank you for that. But before we go, I want to talk a little bit about a little bit of a different topic. You mentioned there your degree kind of teased that a little bit, motorsports engineering. And, you know, besides being an advocate for neuro inclusion at workplaces, one of the things I do my research on you, I know you are quite fond of, are race cars. So if you like, let's talk about racing.
Let's talk about cars.
Let's talk about racing. And how did you get into it? And as you mentioned there earlier, your degree was in motorsports engineering. Did that consist of basically you driving around cars? Or?
Oh, I wish. I wish it was driving. It consisted of a lot of math.
Okay.
So a lot of math, a lot of applied science and applied math as well, and a lot of physics. The degree itself was very insightful because it taught you a lot about the theory of how a car works. Why is it behaving this way? Why did it lose control? How do engines work? How do you move from like combustion engines, so petrol and diesel engines, to electric engines or hybrid engines, hydrogen engine? Basically, everything which you're seeing in the news nowadays, we were being taught how these work. And how you make them more efficient, because what we were talking about was, in theory, what was going to happen within the next 20 years. They were talking about autonomous vehicles, for example, and we're beginning to see that happen now. Like you see the drones and stuff like that. Amazon, for example, their packages, delivering them off. That's like the first stage of autonomous vehicles. So no, we were very much at the forefront into understanding how these systems work. So then we could go into the industry and... be part of the solution going forwards. I've forgotten the second part of your question now.
That's okay. I mean, that was very interesting itself. How did you get into racing?
How did I get into
it? But that was also good to know about a little bit about your degree, because it does like tie in with that.
Definitely.
Anyway, yeah. So how is it something that you've always enjoyed since you were a kid? Or
yeah, there's a picture of me about 18 months old sat on my dad's lap watching an F1 race. So for as long as I can remember, it's always been about cars. It's always been about motorsport. It's also been about trains, but
okay.
I've always wanted to do racing. I always wanted to be involved in it. I always wanted to be involved in anything to do with cars. Like any kids, I think it was always about becoming an F1 champion one day. Then one day I kind of had to accept I was too tall, too fat and too poor to ever make it into Formula One as a driver. But I still wanted to be involved within that industry, hence why I went down the engineering route. I've been doing karting and other forms of motorsport since I was 14. So I've been driving for 20 years now, basically. So I always wanted to be involved in it, help people out in that sense. My strongest area was by far in data analysis.
Okay.
So I know a lot of people hate spreadsheets, whereas to me, nothing gets me more excited than a spreadsheet with 10,000 lines of data in it, minimum.
Oh, wow.
And I got involved in a lot of projects at university. So there's something there called Formula Student, which is, think of Formula One, but the teams are universities. And basically the final year engineering students will do this as their thesis. So it's about designing and building a race car and then going around to different circuits around the world to compete against other universities. It's a prerequisite for getting into F1. If you don't have that on your CV, good luck trying to get a job interview with any of the F1 teams. So for me, that was how I got involved into it more and how I kind of kept on pushing on for it. And I did enjoy working for a couple of different teams within motorsport, within automotive. I did crash test engineering as well. So I got exposed to a lot of it. I don't actually work full-time in motorsport now. I now work in the finance industry in learning and development. But in my side hustle, I still do a lot of projects involved within motorsport. So one of the biggest things at the moment is gamers to race car drivers. I think people may have seen the Gran Turismo film a couple of years ago. I do a contest similar to this, which is about turning gamers into engineers, because it's not just about who's fastest on the game, who's winning. There's a team behind them now because they're looking at the stats. They're looking at the computer. They're going through the maths and the science and problem solving, going, okay, we can get you a competitive advantage there to win this esports contest. So I'm going, okay, you're demonstrating engineering skills there. So I'm actually working with the F1 teams who are supporting this along with the Formula Student to give students a chance to get into engineering that way. this ties back into diversity and inclusion a lot as well, because one of the biggest things, one of the biggest hindrance of motorsport is it's who you know, not what you know.
In what way is it like a connection type of thing?
Absolutely.
It's like, I mean, I guess that's true for a lot of industries.
Oh, every industry, isn't it? It's always, oh, my uncle works here or something.
Who you know rather than what you know.
Exactly. And motorsport is no different at all. Which, you know, I was lucky that I had the correct connections to be able to get involved. But there are so many people out there who won't have that opportunity because they either come from a poorer background. There's a big push on like getting women involved in STEM initiatives, so science, technology, engineering and maths, because typically that's not what they're brought up with as kids, so they get dissuaded from it. We're trying to involve as many different groups in together. What I really enjoy about esports is you don't need to travel to these venues to show what you're worth. You can do this from the comfort of your bedroom on your computer. So rather than knowing someone who gives you the opportunity to prove your worth, you can log onto a server from your computer and demonstrate your skills that way. And that gives you the opportunity to show your worth to the industry and get a job that way instead.
So quick context for listeners, what I've gathered here. It's all virtual, so it makes it accessible for anybody around the world.
Correct.
But that's exciting, though, that you like host and organize these different things. And I want to talk to you about a specific thing that you organized, because I've been doing my research.
You've been doing a lot of research.
Yes, I have.
What have you found out now?
Yes. So what I found out now is back in September 2014... 2024.
Last year,
you hosted a karting event at Rye Courthouse Kart Raceway.
Yes, Rye House, the
Hertfordshire.
Correct.
And it was an aid of the National Autistic Society.
And spot on.
Apparently, it was as well one of your biggest events to date. Which I will read out here. You had over 52 teams.
Yep.
Signed up, and you raised over £5,000.
Could you close 4,800? But yeah, but okay. Basically we were
just
at the five
under
grand.
5,000. Yes. Okay, that's still a huge amount.
I was
amount.
Really proud with that because we were targeting 1,500, so we tripled
Amazing.
Our target.
Amazing.
So we were so proud of that.
Could you tell me more about this event and what it means to you? Because you mentioned there that you were quite proud of.
It's so the National Autistic Society, as far as I'm concerned, them, along with other local charities affiliated with them. It's them I'm thankful for where I am today, because they provided the service to help educate the education facilities which I was at, to help them understand how to enable me. So I was always determined one day I wanted to do something to return the favour so the next generation can get that same support as well. So what enabled me, others get to have that support as well in the future. So for me, it was important to, as I say, return the favour to the charities who had helped me. So for me, the National Autistic Society was a no-brainer because of what they stand for, the services that they offer, and just how wonderful as a team they are into changing people's mindsets and not just educating people, but always putting like a can-do spin on things. So people go, actually, no, that is very easy. Yes, we can help out with this straight away. So for me, it was the least I could do. As part of the esports team which I run, JJ Racing, each year we dedicate a kind of charity event to the chosen charity. So as I say, National Autistic Society was the no-brainer for me as to who I wanted to dedicate this to. The event itself is called Racing Awareness 4. Very punny, yes. But yeah, Racing Awareness 4, the National Autistic Society. And I spoke to Rye House, told them what I was thinking of doing. Is this an event that they could help with? And they said, yes, absolutely. It was quite consistent with other charities which they've supported in the past. Fun fact, Lewis Hamilton, this was his childhood karting track. And Lewis Hamilton's been quite open about his journey with dyslexia as well. So neurodiversity is something which Rye House are affiliated with as well, I believe. So to them, it was a no-brainer to help support with this. And they very kindly donated 20% of each entry fee of this event to the charity as well. The event itself was fun. It was a 90-minute race, like a relay race. So teams would pay for the cart, and they could have three or four drivers to a cart. And basically, like at 30 minutes, come into the pit, swap drivers over, let's go for the next 30 minutes. So basically, stay on the track, do as many laps as you can in 90 minutes, and then we declare the winner from there. And so, yeah, 52 teams turned up last season. That was our biggest one to date. We had F1 journalists turn up as well. Representatives, so engineers and team personnel from 7 of the F1 teams were there as well. And even Nick Hamilton, Lewis's brother, made an appearance as well and was very, very grateful for him giving up his time to be part of the fun. It was great to be able to support autism and to get so many different reputable characters within the various industries together to celebrate and talk about autism.
Oh, wow, that's exciting. Because, yeah, that was one of the things I saw when doing research on this particular event that, yeah, you mentioned there Nicholas Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And was it your idea to get him on board or how did that come about?
I have to actually thank a Jersey-based racer, Jack Butel, who I've known since he was a kid. He does a lot of touring car racing nationally now. And he said he would turn up for it. And he's like, oh, I'll bring someone along as well. I was like, oh, okay, I think it was going to be a friend or something. No, Nicholas Hamilton turns up.
Oh, going, so you were surprised.
Oh, hello. So yeah, it was a real positive surprise. He said he was going to ask him, but I wasn't actually expecting anything of it. And lo and behold, get to Rye House. There's Jack. There's Nick. Hello. So a man of his words, Jack Butel. So thank you, Jack.
Oh, wow. So you essentially showed up to your event thinking, oh, yeah, I'll just do this. And then, yeah, so that was a whole surprise to you as
absolutely.
Well. Wow.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's definitely a great surprise.
Oh, yeah.
Will you be hosting another one of these events in the future?
I will be. So that was part of the reason why I was at Battersea Park today. So I've literally just launched this year's kart race there, guys. So Racing Awareness will be back for another season. I'll pop a poster in the bio for you guys to have a look at. But yes, 11th of October, we're going to be running the event again this year. So we've got 52 carts to fill up again. If you want to get involved this year, if you know of anyone else who wants to get involved, share the link. I'd love to beat last year's target as well. It's great fun. We have 2 classes running, 1 for corporate entries. So you don't even need to have a driver's license. So long as you're over 16 years old and you like motorsport, come along, pay for one of the cart entries and we'll get you sorted out. And then the other class afterwards, that's what we call the professional class. So for anyone with an actual racing license, motorsports license, then we put the fast boys together. So then that way we have 2 different classes going on together. So much fun. Very, very close racing as well. And a lot of tied hands afterwards.
Is it one of those where can anybody at any level join?
Absolutely. Do you want to join?
I might. Yeah, I might take you up on that offer.
Do it.
For context, guys, I don't have a license. I'm a terrible driver. I've only ever driven 1 meter in my entire life at a abandoned parking lot, and that was it for me. That was it for me.
Oh, I think we can do better. We can get you to 2 meters now.
Okay, I guess, guys, I guess I'll be there in October.
Thank you, Jen.
Oh, my
looking
goodness,
forward to welcoming
that
you.
Would be...
Bring your friends along as well.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, I think like 5 teams last year, they didn't have driver's licenses at all. Like they were 16, 17, someone was 30. Couldn't drive for medical reasons, but he was allowed to try like rental carts and that. He was fit enough to drive those. So he's like, yeah, I'll have a try. Loved it.
Amazing.
Loved every minute of it. He came 12th out of 26 as well. So fairly handy.
Right. Wow. Okay. But no, honestly, James, thank you. Thank you so much for today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, I just want to end this interview with a question that I'll be asking everybody that comes on this show.
Okay.
And that would be, what does kindness mean to you?
What does kindness mean to me? Putting your personal preferences aside and acknowledging what is important to the other person.
That's lovely. That is so nice. Thank you so much, lovely listeners. That is it today for kindness sake. If you enjoyed this episode, please do not forget to share, subscribe, rate and review, all that wonderful stuff. You can also follow us on Instagram and TikTok. Descriptions, links and handles will be on the description of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Genevieve, and for the sake of it, be kind. Bye-bye.